Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm your host, Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. Excuse me. A 13-year-old boy is suspected and likely will be charged with using a gun last week to shoot and kill another 14-year-old boy near an elementary school on the east side of Columbus. Tragedies like these have become all too common in the United States. Gun violence is now the leading cause of death for American children, and about 3 million more witness some form of gun violence every year. We're talking about gun violence among the youth today, and joining me now in studio is Reinhart Chair of Mass Communication, Professor of Communication at Ohio State University, Brad Bushman. Brad, welcome.
Thank you.
He researches youth violence. Also an expert on urban youth violence and violence prevention, an associate professor in the Department of Human Science at Ohio State University, Deanna Wilkinson. Welcome, Deanna.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone today is Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Michigan, Dr. Patrick Carter. Dr. Carter researches youth gun violence. Welcome to the show, Dr. Carter.
Thank you.
I appreciate you all being here. And I do want to make the point, starting right off, that we are going to be discussing gun violence among teens, but not the criminal aspect as much as other factors. And I know this is a broad question, and I'm going to open it up to all of you, to the big why. I mean, is there one or two answers as to why this is happening, why kids are killing kids, why kids are killing themselves, how kids are getting guns? So we've seen so much of it is the why. And I know, Deanna, you have worked with kids in the community for many years. Have you come to a conclusion as to a why?
Well, I think you've premised the question as if it's more intensive now than it has been in the past, which is not true. It's consistently been the leading cause of death over the last 30 years. And the questions of why and how all relate back to how many guns we have in our society, how unsafe children feel in their own community, and how having a gun affects all the decisions that happen. The way that kids get guns is something that is our society is failing. And so I think it's a very complicated problem mm-hmm. that has a long history, and how we respond to it hasn't changed that much over all this time, even though we understand the problem really well, I think.
Brad?
There's some deadly statistics. The U.S. is the most heavily armed society in the world. In 2013, there were 40 million more guns than there were citizens in the United States, and that difference continues to grow each year since 2013. The U.S. is only about 4 or 5% of the world's population, but U.S. citizens have almost half of the world's guns, 48% of the world's guns. 68% of U.S. households that have guns do not secure them. 1.7 million children live in a home with unsecured guns. Nearly 50 children every day are shot in the U.S., often as a result of finding an unsecured gun. And American children are 10 times more likely to die by unintentional gun shootings than children from any other developed country. So guns are not regulated very well in the U.S. They're easily accessible. There's a lot of them. So
in your opinion, the gun has contributed to the violent
acts. For sure.
Yeah. Dr. Carter, you work in an emergency room. You see a lot of these gunshot victims, I am sure. Do you agree with this aspect that part of the why is the availability of guns?
You know, I'll add to one of the statistics that Brad mentioned, which is when you look at the top 20 for most developed countries in the world, 90% of firearm deaths among children and youth occur in the United States. Hmm. So, you know, this is a uniquely American problem, and mm-hmm. we do not have higher rates of non-firearm-related homicide or urban crime rates that are higher than other countries. We don't have higher rates of adolescent fighting or bullying or mental illness or teen alcohol use or dependence or any of the other factors that we know are associated with violence and self-inflicted violence. We don't have higher rates of those things, but the easy accessibility of firearms really does make this a uniquely American problem.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, Deanna, that you said this isn't a new problem. Has it become more apparent to people because of coverage and news media and things that people think it's a new problem? Or have we really escalated with more and more guns, making it more of a prevalent problem?
Well, I think when you study it over 30 years like I have, I guess I feel like I've become a little cynical, because when I was a young faculty member and studying this, it seemed like it was it's so explosive. Like the peak of youth gun violence happened in 1993 in our country, and the rates are lower now, but it's still, every death is one too many. And we're not moving in the direction of changing the systems that make young people feel like it's important for them to arm themselves.
Dr. Carter, in your research, why have you come to any conclusions that are factors in why this is a contributing problem, that kids are killing kids?
Well, I think it's maybe important, as Deanna sort of mentioned, this isn't a new problem, and the sort of peak of youth firearm violence was in the early 90s. I think what maybe has changed is we're seeing more coverage of mass and school shootings, which I think has raised the sort of profile of this among the public, although it's not to certainly people who've been studying this for a long time. This is not a new problem. This is not something that has really dramatically shifted in any way over time. I mean, firearms have been the leading cause of death, especially for young urban African American youth for a long time, for several decades, and we haven't done enough to address that problem. And I think that it's becoming more apparent in the public, because it's getting more media attention of these sort of mass shootings. But the day-to-day toll of firearm violence has been there and has been there for a long time. I will mention that since 2013, we have seen an increase, especially among youth populations, in both suicide and homicide, which I think has mm-hmm. also sparked some increased attention on this problem, about a 30-40% increase in both homicides and suicides.
I guess that was kind of my issue, too, is are we seeing a lot of the same violence, but with younger people? Brad?
Speaking of mass killings, on the way to the studio today, I heard about a mass stabbing in Japan in which two victims were killed.
Yes.
And I wondered if the perpetrator had two knives, and I wondered if the perpetrator had guns instead, if the number of casualties would have been much higher than two.
How do you define gun violence then? It's violence a use against themselves sometimes too, not just against other people.
Violence is any act intended to cause extreme physical harm to another person who wants to avoid that harm, usually injury or death. So gun violence would be using a gun to cause or threaten to cause such an extreme physical act of to harm another person.
Deanna, do you think that the accessibility of guns for young people is part of the problem?
Oh, absolutely. And we don't have an effective way of dealing with that. And the politicalization of this issue has kind of made it seem like it's off the table. It's not something that we can consider because it's so political. And then when we think about where it's happening and how it's happening, that's a whole other layer of what kind of response we have. If the shooter's a white suburban kid versus if the shooter is an inner city black kid, and our response to it is different and it's not effective.
Dr. Carter, you see in the emergency room, as I stated before, victims. Where do you find that these young people are getting firearms?
So, and most of my research has been done among those folks who come into the emergency department, but among youth and primarily done with kind of urban youth populations, but we know that among that population specifically, about 80% of the firearms are acquired from illegal sources, so diversion of firearms from legal channels of sale to illegal sources. But among kids in other communities, we also know that firearms are often acquired from the home and that are not stored safely. And I think Brad was alluding to that earlier. And And so, you know, there's a diverse array of sources for folks getting firearms, both from relatives and from the home, being given them as a means of protecting themselves, or acquiring them through illegal channels like buying from a person who's a street seller of guns. And so there's an array of different ways of obtaining these guns, but it's that easy accessibility that I think is a key problem, part of the problem.
It's funny, Dr. Carter, when you said that kids are getting some of the guns in the home. Both Dan and Brad were nodding yes in here. That's a problem that you look at it and go, this is something we could change easily. Mm-hmm. And that has to be very frustrating to both of you who have worked with this problem, especially you, Deanna. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do we convince people that having a gun in the home, if that's what you want, needs to be secured?
Oh, absolutely. And it's an easy solution. And I'm sure Brad is really on top of this research, but when the studies that look at what parents think of whether or not kids know where their guns are hidden in their houses, they're always wrong. The kids know and can find these guns, and particularly if you have adolescent boys or preteens boys, they go through a socialization process where their curiosity with that gun and the peer influence on whether or not you've carried a gun, you've felt what it feels like, you've shot a gun, all of those things kids experience, boys in particular, experience together as a socialization process. And parents are completely in the dark, and I think stay in the dark about it because they don't want to have that conversation. They don't want to ask other parents if they have a gun in the house and if it's secure. And I mean, I remember going through this with my own sons, asking parents of another family, and they looked at me like I was, you know, a crazy person.
Like, if your kid's going to stay all night at someone's house.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have a gun in the house? Mm-hmm. And if you do, is it in a locked place?
Right.
Yeah, Brad, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Deanna's absolutely right. And one thing she talked about is how political this issue has become. But both gun owners and non-gun owners agree that guns are not toys. The children should not be playing with guns. So there is some common ground on this issue.
And it's a seriousness that they want to bring to parents or to whoever has a gun in the home. Brad, you have done research, and a big part of your research has been children looking at videos or movies involving guns. And so does that in a child's mind or a young person's mind make it feel like it's okay?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the studies that we conducted looked at the number of acts of gun violence in movies. And for example, in PG-13 movies, that rating was introduced in 1983. And we just counted the number of acts of gun violence every year in movies since then. And it's more than tripled since the rating was introduced. And gun violence in PG-13 movies that target children contain more gun violence than R-rated movies. So gun violence is definitely increasing in movies. And would you like me to tell you about the study that we did? Or
we're going to take a break.
Okay.
And when we do, I want to hear about the study,
sure,
because it is very interesting in how what children see and how that influences their own behavior. You are listening to Brad Bushman. He's with the Reinhardt Chair of Mass Communication and Professor of Communication at Ohio State University. Deanna Wilkinson is an expert on urban youth violence and violence prevention, an associate professor in the Department of Human Sciences at OSU, and on the phone, Dr. Patrick Carter, an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the University of Michigan. We will be right back, and then we will continue this conversation. You are listening to All Sides at WOSU.org.
In WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Gail Hogan, sitting in for Anne, who's on vacation. We're talking about gun violence among the young people today, with news that a 13-year-old boy is suspected and likely will be charged with using a gun last week to shoot and kill another 14-year-old boy on the east side of Columbus. And I know, Deanna, you want to address that in a little bit. We have three guests with us today, two in the studio, Reinhardt Chair of Mass Communication, Professor of Communication at Ohio State University, Brad Bushman. He researches youth violence, an expert on urban youth violence and violence prevention, Associate Professor in the Department of Human Sciences at OSU, Deanna Wilkinson, and by phone, youth gun violence researcher and Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Michigan, Dr. Patrick Carter. Thank you all for staying with me. Brad, you have done research, and we alluded to that before we took our break. Can you explain what you have found in some of your research regarding what children see and then how they react?
Sure. Well, children think media characters are really cool, and they often imitate their behavior. So previous research, for example, has shown that children who see movie characters drink alcohol, they're more likely to drink alcohol themselves. Children who see movie characters smoke cigarettes are more likely to smoke cigarettes themselves. But we know virtually nothing about what happens when children see movie characters with guns. How does that influence their attitudes about guns? And do they engage in more dangerous behavior around real guns following exposure to media characters who have guns? Because those characters are often cool and tough and powerful.
And young people are very impressionable.
They are, right. So I did a study with my former PhD student, Kelly Dillon, who's now a professor at Wittenberg. And we tested 104 children. They were 8 to 12 years old. We brought them in pairs. We just told the kids we're interested in what children like to do in their spare time. Watch movies, play with toys, play with games. So first we're going to show you a movie and you can tell us what you think about it. And by the flip of a coin, we showed them a movie with or without guns. We used two different movies just to increase the generalizability of the findings, National Treasure and Rocketeer. These are both PG movies.
And what was the outcome of that?
Yeah. Well, then what we did is we put them in a room with lots of toys and games. And in the room, there is a cabinet with a real handgun. And we modified, the gun was, of course, disabled, but we modified it with a digital counter that we could count the number of times they pulled the trigger. And what we found is that children who saw the movie with guns, they held the real gun longer, 53 seconds versus 11 seconds for those who saw it without guns. And they pulled the trigger more times, three times versus 0.01, basically no times for the children who saw the movie without guns. So we know that children exposed to movie characters with guns engage in more dangerous behavior around real guns.
And Deanna, do you think that's part of the problem of why we see and just what happened here in Columbus? Kids at that age still think they're invincible, and that's part of it too? Or do they understand really what will happen when they pull that trigger?
No, I think they don't understand what will happen, or they're not capable of really understanding the full ramifications of the decisions they're making and the what I've called scripts of violence that young people have internalized based on watching what older teens are doing. And I studied 416 young men in New York City in two neighborhoods two decades ago, and about their decision making and what they do when they're armed and angry and why they get guns and how, you know, sort of how that all evolved from their early development. And victimization was a common thread across all of the individuals that later went on to become perpetrators of gun violence, and feeling unsafe and watching other people use violence to gain power in social situations. And that whole process, even though that study was done quite a long time ago, I've worked with so many young people since here in Columbus and in other cities, that same story is retold generation after generation. And for individuals who live in neighborhoods that violence is common, they need to protect themselves, and they learn the process of doing that and what role guns play in that. And so the stakes get increased.
So it's for protection, but also is a hierarchy thing, too.
Absolutely.
And Dr. Carter, what did your research show concerning both of these topics, one, what children see and what they do, and also, you know, why they have guns.
Well, you know, I would piggyback on just what Deanna said. I mean, her research was really foundational in helping us understand and understanding why kids, especially in urban communities, have and carry guns. And, you know, protection is always the thing that you hear, but it is really about what they witness in their communities and the behaviors that they that they see, and then how they can see to protect themselves, how they can feel safe in the environment that they're in. And there may not be a trust of police or other organizations, and there's a need to defend themselves and you know, both from, you know, generalized violence that's going on in the community, as well as from prior arguments that may escalate into armed conflict, especially, you know, if there's other things going on, such as substance use or alcohol or drug use. And we know, especially among teens who don't have developed brains yet, that those things can rapidly escalate to conflict where they don't understand what the consequences are and have tragic outcomes.
Deanna, does part of it have to do with a child's upbringing, not just demographic, but if they are from an abusive home and they see that violence, no matter where the child lives, if have seen a violent act that has given them PTSD, I mean, do these kinds of things factor into it as well?
Well, I think the response we have to it is just as important of whether or not they've been exposed. So in one study I did with Philadelphia youth, I found that if a child had a protective factor, just one, it could help that person overcome a whole list of risk factors. So the negative is always something that we focus on, but what we fail to focus on is the protective factors that help a kid become resilient and overcome really the things that they see around them, because they're focused on a positive pathway. They maybe make decisions to not spend time in certain places because of, you know, it might be dangerous or things like that. And so all the exposures that they get in the home and in the community, and, you know, I think about this situation and I hope and pray that all of the children who witnessed this tragedy that happened in Columbus,
yes,
get trauma care, get grief counseling, and that it doesn't just last for a couple of days. And, you know, you think about these mass shootings and things that happen and the, you know, other resources that get brought into communities. That doesn't happen for urban kids in urban communities. And what does happen is the demonization of this 13-year-old boy. And, you know, I don't know the details of this situation, but all the families that are involved are suffering right now. And what are we doing as a community to be wrapping resources around them to help everyone cope with this? And all of the kids who witness this situation, it's going to have ripple effects on their mental health for a long time. And we don't do enough. And that's part of the reason why I've kind of changed my career focus, is because it's really quite overwhelming to be part of a community that deals with this over and over again without an appropriate type of response, and that, you know, in some ways it becomes normalized and acceptable, and it's not.
And it's not. You talk about that this is overwhelming. It is an overwhelming problem. Are there, and I'm going to open this question up to all of you, including you, Dr. Carter, are there ways that we can make small improvements that can make a big difference? As we sit here, I mean, are we going about it backwards? Are we doing the wrong things? I mean, Brad, should we really be telling parents, video games, you got to look what your child's watching? Or do we need more parental responsibility when it comes to things like what are your kids watching? There's so many factors. Anyone?
So I'll take one stab.
Please.
Here, and then I'll let Brad, Deanna answer, but I think it's a little bit all of the above. So, I mean, I'm a big proponent of more research in this area in order to figure out, I mean, Deanna hit the nail on the head when she talked about resilience and enhancing resilience factors for these kids, and that's a key component of a lot of the work that we've been doing in emergency departments with individual-level interventions for kids who come in who may be engaged or involved in violence, or even in the beginning stages of violence, and how do we build their resilience and move them away from being engaged in that, both at the individual level, and then we need to tie that to the greater community level, and what are we doing as a whole community in order to address this problem? And I think the key component of that is, what works and what doesn't work. And I think there's things that can be done both with individuals in emergency departments or in schools or in other settings, the community-wide level projects that can be done to decrease violence and violent outcomes. And then I think there are also likely policy things that can be done. But I think we need to know more about what works and what doesn't work, and we need to study that, and then we need to figure that out, and then we need to implement those things more widespread across the communities that are affected by this problem. And to be clear, every community is affected by fire and violence in one way, shape, or another. I mean, we know now with all these school shootings that these kids are running drills in terms of how to protect themselves should an armed shooter come in, and we have no idea what effect that has on the kids as they're developing in these communities. We know that suicide is much more prevalent among rural communities, and we haven't addressed that effectively. And so all of our communities are affected by this, and we all need to be focused on what are the solutions to the problems.
Thank you. Deanna, Brad?
I don't think there's any single solution, but it's probably a multi-pronged approach. So I just read recently an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics issue, and they talked about what would happen if gun owners just secured their guns. And I think if just 10% more gun owners would secure their guns, 50 less children would die every year. If 20% more, 100 less children would die every year. And they did it up to 50%. So 250 less children would die every year if half of gun owners would just lock up their guns. So
it's a start.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge start, especially if, 250 children is a staggering number.
Right.
And I do research on violent media, so a lot of people think it's harmless, but it's not. It's not the only risk factor or the most important risk factor, but it's definitely not a trivial risk factor. Mm-hmm. So parents should protect their children from media containing violence and talk to their children about such media.
We are with Dr. Patrick Carter, Brad Bushman, and Deanna Wilkinson. And if you'd like to give us a call concerning our conversation today, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Deanna, we haven't talked about the criminal aspect of this, meaning crime on the streets leading some to use guns. Do you view gang-related incidents, the rise of opioids, all those things contributing to any sort of escalation?
Well, I think in kids who are in communities where gangs are present, initiation into gang is often by putting a gun in a kid's hand and basically demanding that that kid complete some kind of criminal act in order to move forward with their gang membership. And the other side of that is sort of forcing membership by, if you want to be safe in this space, this is how you act. And so, yes, it's a huge, huge thing, because if you think about a community where other young people and young adults are armed, and you're trying to navigate through that space and you don't want to be armed, you either need to group up, which mm-hmm. is what the kids would call it, or arm yourself and group up, because it's not going to be, you're not going to be safe just doing one or the other.
So you're saying in many instances, it's survival of the fittest for these young people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is in the absence of resources to overcome that cycle. That is what happens.
We haven't talked about suicide by gun, and that's another violent act that is on the increase. And Deanna, you said that this has been a problem as far as violence, youth on youth. But I think that suicide is actually on the rise. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Carter, I don't know what you see in the medical institution, but what do you have to say about the fact that so many young people feel so disheartened and hopeless that that's what they resort to, using a gun?
Yeah, and I mean, I go back to this accessibility issue. So we know that when a kid, that kids who attempt to kill themselves, we know that often they plan for a very short period of time, usually less than 5 minutes of planning. And so it's often a very impulsive act. We know that that's a trait, obviously, among all of us who have teenagers. The impulsivity of teenagers is a huge issue. And so it's really the access to the firearm in that moment that is really the highly lethal component of this. If a kid attempts to kill themselves with almost any other means, they are often not successful because we're able to get them the medical resources that are necessary in time to prevent them from fatally injuring themselves. But in the case of a firearm, firearms are 90% fatal when somebody tries to shoot themselves.
Wow.
So, you know, it's the accessibility of that firearm in that moment that is really the key issue. And we know that most of these kids who survive, the overwhelming majority of these kids who survive, don't go on to have another suicide attempt and don't go on to kill themselves. So so really it's about addressing those needs in that moment and preventing them from accessing something that is highly lethal as a firearm.
Interesting. I see that point coming up again and again in this conversation about accessibility to guns for young people and one way that we could put a stop to so many of this if we just took that time. Brad.
I was on President Obama's Gun Violence Committee, and I went to the National Academies of Science, and I just want to corroborate what Dr. Carter just said. One of the speakers there talked about suicide and specifically mentioned there's like a 5-minute critical period where people decide, am I going to do it? Am I going to carry it out? And the statistics that were presented at that meeting were that if a gun was available during that 5-minute period of time, 91% of people successfully killed themselves. But if there was not a gun available, it was only 18%. So a huge difference in the accessibility of a gun. And most gun-related deaths are suicides. So this is really an important issue.
We're going to take a break here. We have been talking about young people and guns, the availability, crime against young people and young people, crime against each other. We're with Dr. Patrick Carter, an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the University of Michigan. Brad Bushman is the Reinhardt Chair of Mass Communication, professor of communication at Ohio State University. And Anna Wilkinson, an expert on urban youth violence and violence prevention and associate professor in the Department of Human Sciences. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Please do give us a call. We'd love to talk with you. Or email us. The number is 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Gail Hogan, sitting in for Anne, and we are talking about gun violence among young people today. And in our previous conversations, we have discussed the whys and how it's happening. And I think now we want to take a look at maybe are there some ways, small ways, that we can change what we are seeing? Still with me, Reinhardt Chair of Mass Communication, Professor of Communication at OSU, Brad Bushman. Expert on urban youth violence and violence prevention, associate professor in the Department of Human Science at OSU, Deanna Wilkinson, and by phone, youth gun violence researcher and associate professor of emergency medicine at the University of Michigan, Dr. Patrick Carter. Thank you all for staying with me. And I want to start with you, Deanna, because it's interesting that your career took a trajectory. You were on the streets, literally, and then you backed away. Explain some of those reasonings and what led you to what you are doing today.
Well, I spent a good chunk of my early career studying both the perpetrators and victims of gun violence and trying to unpack the decisions that young people make in the moment when they're armed and angry and the community processes that explain how that happens. And in the course of that was sort of basic science, really trying to get at the whys and hows. Mm-hmm. And then from that, I when I moved to Columbus, decided I wanted to work on intervention strategies based on what was learned there, and worked very closely in partnership with Pastor Fred Lamar and Cecil Ahad with Ministries for Movement, which I'm still involved with, but I had to shift my role because we spent a lot of time on the front lines trying to intervene and intervening, preventing gun violence from happening in the area of Columbus that was the second highest for pretty much a decade. And in the course of that work, we worked really hard to help young people change their lives, get out of the gang, take a positive pathway in their life after they have been involved in a life of violence. That's not the only attribute of their lives, but, that was what we were working on. And three people that I have been working with were murdered in pretty close. And after they had changed their lives, they sort of got out of it, just kind of random situations. And
it had to be heartbreaking for you.
It was heartbreaking. And, you spend enough time with people who deal with this every single day. I didn't have the strength and the courage to keep plowing through it. But, my partners in the community, they still are doing this. They are still in the lives. And so I guess...
You took a different turn. Now.
I did. Well, and I'm still doing the work. I'm just doing it in a different way.
Right.
When you go to enough funerals of young people and help families grieve and bury their children and try to move on, every single mother that I know who has buried her child every day is a living hell. And, it's just, you have to be a really special kind of person to do this work and know that the community needs so much healing, needs understanding and not ways of inspiring hope versus focusing on this as an inevitable problem, because it is all preventable in my view. Mm-hmm. And I think there's plenty of research that it is preventable, and we don't put the resources where they need to be to keep young people on a positive track and make them see the world as a place of opportunity versus a place of death and dying.
Mm-hmm. Brad?
I don't have anything to add. I think we should focus on protective factors as well as risk factors. So one risk factor in our own research is being a male. It's like almost the biggest risk factor that in many studies is being a male and having positive attitudes about guns. A lot of people think that carrying a gun will make them more safe, but actually it makes them less safe. So changing some of those attitudes is important, and targeting high risk portions of the population is really important, and focusing on protective factors as well as risk factors is really important.
Dr. Carter, are we going about some of this in the wrong way in trying to solve this problem?
Well, I think I would echo kind of what's already been said, which is that I think in order to solve a problem, you have to put the resources into addressing it. And this is a completely preventable problem, mm-hmm. Both from the spectrum of unintentional to self-inflicted to interpersonal violence. And it's all preventable, but mm-hmm. you have to address it with well-funded research that can look at what works, and then you have to take those interventions once you figure out that they work, and you have to be able to implement them in communities, and you have to have resources to do that implementation community-wide and address the fundamental underlying problems that that are affecting communities and people in those communities that lead to these outcomes.
And Deanna, you've been doing some of that yourself with your own inspired gardening with young people and trying to I will let you explain exactly what it is, what you do, but it's kind of like farm to table for kids in the inner city.
Yeah. So you got to think creatively about ways that can bring people together to do something positive. And so I started a gardening program in partnership with Family Missionary Baptist Church initially. And I found that kids, teens, and younger kids got really excited about working in the garden, growing their own food, having something that they keep alive. And I found for me that it was very therapeutic. And then the other major need that kids have is a way to make money and a way to be able to provide for their families and to, you know, all of those things. So I kind of took what I learned about what is missing or what kids are seeking and developed a program called Urban Gems, where GEM stands for Gardening, Entrepreneurs, Motivating Sustainability, where we work through a curriculum that I developed called the Facets, eight facets, and teach young people to grow their own food, prepare their own food, be entrepreneurs, sell the food in the community, and think about how do we motivate positive health in our communities, positive images of Black kids and urban communities, and then how do we sustain all of that? And so having a business that we're selling the food. And
so you've got all the angles covered there in many respects.
Well, and the other thing that makes that possible is a long-term commitment to a community. So I've been working on the South Side for 10 years in partnership. And even, you know, as I've had my own personal struggles in doing that work, I want to have a difference, a lasting difference in that community. And I know in the young people that I've been working, investing in them, investing in the community and seeing all the positive. And the garden's an easy thing to see as a positive mm-hmm. because it's beautiful, it's alive.
They receive results.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
We're going to take a phone call now. This is Thomas from Columbus. You're on the air. Thomas, your question, please. Can't hear. Thomas, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, there you go. Your question, please.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you to the panel, because I must say I'm ashamed to live in the only country that has to teach children how to stop bleeding. Mm-hmm. I'm a Vietnam vet. The first time a child tried to kill you, it was devastating. The second time, it was shocking. The third time, it was routine. They became conditioned, and so did we. So my question is, the 13-year-old made the choice to take this guy out permanently instead of just punching him out and running off with the cell phone. Mm-hmm. Can he be rehabilitated to the innocence of a child?
Hmm. Once they've gone down this path, can they turn back? Well, I know, Deanna, you've had probably more experience, and maybe you too, Dr. Carter, with the actual child who's gone through this and then trying to find a way back.
Well, I guess I don't see it as a path where this person is necessarily going to repeat this action. I think I don't know any of the details about this particular situation, but I know from many, many interviews with young people who have gone down this path that most of the days of their lives, they don't do something like this. And the number of factors that lined up to the difference between what ends up in a shooting and what doesn't, mm-hmm. many of those things have to do with the crowd that's there, have to do with basically situational dynamics that kind of all line up, and then a shooting happens. But none of that would have happened if he didn't have a gun mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. on him in mm-hmm. the first place. And how the crowd responds and all of those things. I mean, most likely this 13-year-old, based on everything that all the statistics out there on people who have killed someone, that it's not like this is a pathological, you know, I mean, that's where people go, but there's no evidence that that's true.
Yes. Thomas, thank you for your question. And Brad, I'm going to go to you when we talk about what Deanna is saying. Maybe one thing can make an impact. And what about the role of family? What about the role of parents, grandparents, the people that are closest to a child? What can they do besides lock up their guns? And we want to make that point again that that's important. What else can they do?
Well, I think that's the key to a lot of the problems is the family. You know, one thing they can do, a lot of people, for example, think corporal punishment is effective. It's not. It does far more harm than good. So, you know, eliminating corporal punishment, being a good role model of pro-social behavior, teaching their children to have empathy and compassion for others, even things like pets, you know, when you have to care, or even a plant, when you have to keep something alive and care for something, something's counting on you, you can learn a lot from things like that. Nutrition, you know, watching what kind of media their children consume. There's so many things that parents can do to help children, you know, establish some protective factors instead of and reducing these risk factors.
Dr. Carter, is part of a stable family the answer to this, or does it really not have to do with that?
I think it's about, I think going back to sort of what Brad and both Deanna said, I think it's about enhancing protective factors and resilience. Mm-hmm. And I think it's about creating a safe environment for your kids. And you know, that can be a challenge, certainly if you're in a community where there are high rates of violence.
Yes.
and teens are exposed to violence. So it's about working with them and you know, and enhancing those protective factors and really getting them, you know, into good school programs and resources that do exist in the community and getting them involved in, you know, whether that's religious or community programs that really will help to enhance some of those protective factors, as well as working with the kids themselves and trying to keep them away from some of what we know are the risk factors, but also to enhance their resilience for being able to grow up and flourish in a community that may have elevated rates of violence.
And Deanna, and those children who are raised in at-risk neighborhoods, what age is the best age to try to get to that child and get them to understand the safety of their own lives and that violence isn't going to be the answer?
Well, I think every age is the quick answer to that. But from 7 on up, boys experience pressures to demonstrate their toughness, and that changes as they go into the teen years. And so, the thing that happens that I think is a public health and political crisis is that once a kid is 13, there are very few opportunities for them to do something positive outside of a school setting. So the part of the reason why I created Urban Gems for teens, mm-hmm, is that there's this huge void that you can, especially for programs that aren't that are low cost or free to families, there's, you know, just a few different things that kids can do. But if your kid's not into sports or, you know, it's just a huge void. And that's something that, you know, like summer jobs, for example, we have a jobs program here in Columbus. I believe the mayor announced 1,400 jobs for teens. I know 1,400 kids myself who want jobs. That is not enough. What opportunities are there for the 13-year-olds, the 14-year-olds, the kids who are trying.
And then
trying.
You have things about, can they get to the job? And,
right,
all, you know, the resources are limited for some kids as to, even if the job is there, you know, how they get there.
Yeah.
And Brad, I'm going to say one more time, for parents, you know, keep an eye on your children and what they watch. That's another, mm-hmm, thing that parents and family can do. I know it can be easy because if you just need to get something done, it's like, okay, go do that video game or whatever. But
media can have a positive effect as well. We developed an empathy app for children 4 and older. It's free on Android and Apple devices. You can just Google Brad Bushman and download it for free. And to try to counter this tide that so much media is negative in content, but media is a tool. You can use it in a good way or a bad way. So we tried to develop an app to use it in a good way.
Dr. Carter, we have about a minute left. Any final thoughts? Dr. Carter?
Yes. Can you hear
Yes,
me?
I can hear you now. I said we have about a minute left if you had any final thoughts.
Well, I would just – I didn't get a chance to talk about this much, but you know, there is a lot more work being done in this area recently with kind of a, this renewed focus from, as I said, the mass shootings. So I would ask people to take a look at our website on childfirearmsafety.org, which has a lot of great materials on the research being done in this area and some good clinical resources for physicians and other people who are interested in firearm safety.
Thank you all, Dr. Patrick Carter, Brad Bushman, Deanna Wilkinson. Thank you all for being with me today.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm your host, Gail Hogan. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.